Hello, this is Melissa. It is Real History, and today is the 23rd of January, 2025, and I am talking with Allison in Virginia. And we have just been discussing before I hit the record button that it is cold. It's cold where she is, and technically Virginia is considered the South, although it's kind of up north for the South. And it is cold where I am. And I was telling her this weird new weather phenomenon that I observed with my own eyes last night. I was working away at my computer and I glanced down at the lower screen of the computer screen, the lower corner, and it said that it was snowing. It was 29 degrees outside and it was snowing. And I thought, what? I didn't know that was forecast. So I got up and I looked out the window and sure enough, it was snowing. The roof was already covered with snow. The driveway had a dusting of snow on it. So you know that it's cold for it to stick on the driveway. And the ground was covered in snow. I woke up early for me before 7 this morning and I looked out the window first thing and all of the snow was gone. And I thought, well, okay, so it must have gotten above freezing. But I looked at the thermometer and the thermometer right now, it's 24 degrees outside. It is after 10 o'clock in the morning. It's about 10:15, 10:20. So what happened? I mean, did we have a warm front that blew in the night, melted all the snow, and then it got cold again? I mean, this is the, you know, we were talking about making snow ice cream, and Allison said, no, don't do it. So how are you, other than being cold?
Oh, I'm good. I'm really good.
Good. Well, it's nice to talk to you. We've had a lot of email back and forth and spoken before. And you have an interesting background. You've been kind of on the truth hunt for a long time now, a lot of years. And so I don't know, it's an interesting way to start. Maybe we'll start right in at things that you noticed that made you start to question. I think 9/11 was a key one, and then we can work backwards and get some education and background and stuff, or unless you think that the education ties into being able to see the 9/11 inconsistencies.
Oh, gotcha. Well, I don't know. I started noticing things as a child, really. Things didn't add up. Something as simple as like top 40 radio. The music was horrible. Who was picking this top 40? I would call and make requests and my songs never got played. And it's like, well, I didn't get to vote. Who got to vote on this? You know? And I would say things to my friends like, do you like this song? They're like, no. And I'm like, why is it top 40? They're like, I don't know. Just, they didn't want to talk about it, you know? And it upset me because it's on. They play the same songs over and over. And it was like torture having to listen to it. I don't know. I guess I was just really observant. Sorry, my phone's ringing. Let me turn that off. But then like sixth grade, I really noticed, like before sixth grade, like I had all these friends in my neighborhood, and then all of a sudden in sixth grade, everything became politicized. Girls became objects of boys' affection, and my friends who were boys weren't my friends anymore. All of a sudden I was on the other side, it didn't make sense to me. And it's like, personal explanation was, well, they're mimicking their parents or something, you know. I don't know, I just always had this sense that something was wrong, like this existential angst that something's just not right and I can't put my finger on it. I would ask, like, why is it okay that they made corporations persons, which then gave them this sense power and took power out of our hands. Like everything, when the when they had new and improved products, well, they were worse, or there was less of it, or it seemed exactly the same but cost a little more. You know, it always seemed like it worked against us and for the corporation. And anytime I questioned it, I just got these, like, who cares? Like, that's just the way it is. Like, nobody wanted to talk about that kind of thing. And that's the way it is was always the answer for these questions that that itched in my brain. You know, I didn't understand why nobody else was interested in it.
That you may have heard Alan describe exactly that in some of his talks, where he'd ask his parents something or ask a teacher something, and their eyes would just, you know, roll around in their head, you know, like, it was just, well, that's it. That's the way it is.
Right.
But I have to back up already. I have a question for you, which is, now this is going deep into the recesses of your memory bank.
Oh, dear.
But when the top 40 was playing the same thing over and over again, and you were calling into the radio station, saying, play this song.
God, please play something else.
What was one of the, can you remember one of the songs that you requested that they wouldn't play?
Oh, dear. I have to think on that. It'll come to me in a minute.
All right. Okay.
I guess, you know, well, I had like albums at home that I loved. It might have been Kingston Trio or something. It wasn't things that they were playing on,
right,
necessarily household names. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But right, maybe a song will pop into my head as we're talking.
So that was it, just this early awareness that nobody had the answers to the questions that you were asking and things didn't add up.
Those things just built up over time. Like, there was just a lot of these little things that seemed insignificant, but for whatever reason, the way I'm built, I'm a trend watcher, a trend identifier. And it just, things didn't add up. And when I went to work, like, at the mission, I worked for healthcare corporations, and supposedly we're supposed to provide the best service, blah, blah, blah. And when I tried to fulfill the mission, I got in trouble because it didn't maximize shareholder wealth. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. If this is our mission, how can maximizing shareholder wealth kind of goes against, like, it's opposed to, if we maximize shareholder wealth, then our mission gets compromised because we can't do the best of both. They're opposed to each other. One costs money out of the shareholder's pocket, you know, and I didn't have the words to articulate it then, but really I felt like it was a big lie. And and when I would talk to my coworkers, that got nowhere. They're like, well, just do what you need to do to get a promotion or a raise or whatever, just don't worry about it, you know. And I just never could fit in. I wasn't interested in corporate speak and talking to people at lunchtime about things that just were trivial, you know, and building relationships in that environment. It did not fulfill me in any way. I used to look out the window, literally. I worked for Ernst & Young. I had a great job.
Ernst & Young, for those who might not know, that's one of the big accounting firms.
Right. At the time, it was like one of six, one of the big six or big four. I can't remember now. But it was.
Isn't Ernst & Young the one who always gives the winners at the Oscar? Or is that a different one? Remember,
I think that's a different one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I won't be able to recall their name.
That's all right. It's trivia. But so you did, you went through high school and everything, and then the first thing, because you've had some interesting and varied things across your lifespan of working, but the first thing that you did educationally was the degree in finance. Is that right?
Yeah, so I got a degree in finance, and right out of the gate, I wanted to go to Wall Street and trade stocks or something. And everybody I interviewed with, you know, they wanted to know how much accounting I had. And my answer in my mind was as little as possible. And that was not the right answer. And so I went back. I only needed like two classes to get a management information systems degree because there was a lot of overlap in the required courses. So I went back to tech, and of course they wouldn't let me just go take those two classes. So I had to go for two semesters, but I ended up getting a degree in management information systems. And then I got a job in, for a telephone company running a computer system there. And I did data analysis, was ended up being part of my job. It wasn't, actually assigned to me, but I did it because I noticed trends in the data, and I would go through the files using DOS to mine the data, which now seems pretty like dinosaurish technology to mine through data. But that's what I did. I literally sorted data using DOS commands in text files to find where the glitches were and to get statistics to show the people that ran the company, look, this is, we have these many calls, these have these many hiccups, we got to fix the software. So, but I just kind of did that on my own. That wasn't really my assigned job.
Mm-hmm. How long did you work in finance at that before?
Well, I never really worked in finance. I never got a job. I right out of the gate ended up doing the phone company was really my first, what I would consider a real job, that had a career trajectory of any sort. And from there, I took a job with a mental hospital, as their computer liaison person for that hospital and the headquarters and other hospitals. And I wasn't there long before I was recruited into Ernst & Young.
Okay.
I had a connection there. I knew my father was friends with one of the partners in the healthcare management consulting group. And so they wanted somebody literally to use spreadsheets to manage their golf scores. They didn't know how to use their computers for anything. So, or that's all they were using them for. And they're like, I think we need to learn, because they were starting to get, the laptop computers were this, you know, they were big. They were like a heavy suitcase at that time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they had desktop computers and they were expected to use them. And so they needed somebody to kind of show them what the computers were good for. And that's really what I was hired for. But I ended up being a consultant that worked with hospitals and SNF facilities, skilled nursing facilities, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But so back to as a child, like one of the things that always bothered me was in the 70s, like the movies, they always upset me because there was always, I didn't recognize what it was then, but it was really, really a pedophilic theme, underlying theme, like Little Darlings, Foxes, Young Girls, with a sexualized tone about it. And I always felt uncomfortable with that. And then I always wondered with music, you know, why is everything about sex? Why is everything about objectification? Well, I was really sensitive to the sexual objectification of females. And I guess maybe that's why in sixth grade, I really was like, what is going on here? So,
yeah, you know, that I understand what you're saying too. It's, I had some friends years ago, probably 20, 25 years ago, and they had a little, their first child together. And it was her first marriage and his second, and he actually had four boys from his previous marriage. Mm-hmm. So together, they had a girl. So her first baby was the girl. And they talked about the infant. This was an infant, you know, little baby, and it would have that little headband on or something. And she'd say, oh, she's just a heartbreaker. She's a total flirt. The guys are just going to be crazy about it. I mean, this is an infant.
Right.
And of course, over the years, I heard people speaking that way about their, you know, little toddler girls. But I thought,
it's cringeworthy.
That's just, yeah, it really is. It really is.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. And I always wondered, you know, why? Well, you know, I was a tomboy and I liked the boys' toys better than mine. Like, I wanted to play cowboys and Indians and play with the G.I. Joe and all of that. And I didn't, you know, they would get Barbies and this and that. I wasn't interested in those. And then the colors, the pink versus the blue, the assignment of the colors. I was like, why are we pink and they're blue? Like, I like blue better. You know, and I never could get an answer for that. And I was very liberal, extreme. I would say, you know, bleeding heart liberal up until COVID, when that narrative hit. Then I was like jerked into all of a sudden being on the other side of the fence. And in a weird way, I was like, suddenly was like at my mom's house watching Fox News, which was on there all the time, which I normally cringed every time it was on. All of a sudden I agreed with half of what they were saying. I'm like, what's wrong with me? I can't believe I agree with Tucker Carlson, you know?
Well, back up to 9/11, because where were you and what were you doing? Because when we talked before, you had a very immediate reaction to what was going on that started you. Now, you may have stayed liberal with the exploration into different ideas about what might really be happening, but 9/11 was a very pivotal.
That was big. I had quit my corporate job when I was 32. After Ernst & Young, I went to a subsidiary of Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And I did that for 3 or 4 years. And I was like, I can't take this anymore. I'm going to art school. And
okay. Wait, now I know I asked you to take me to 9/11, but there was something that you told me that you were doing at Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is a huge health insurance in the U.S. And you were describing some of the data that you were providing them. And specifically, it was, is it cost effective to, like, for instance, give education to, like, prenatal education as opposed to not providing prenatal education? Did they save money as insurers, or did they spend more money on those kind of programs? And the work that you did was very interesting to me. And it was also, it tells something kind of ugly about the corporate mentality, the way they ignore reality for the bottom line. But that was.
So my job, I was hired to write client reports for the subsidiary was called Health Management Corporation. And what they did, their primary service was these programs to improve people's health and to improve outcomes, basically. Their prime service was called Baby Benefits, and it was a cutting edge nursing 24-hour nursing line and they sent educational materials to pregnant women, and it basically encouraged them to follow certain protocols while they were pregnant so that they would have better delivery outcomes. And so I literally, like, and their clients were huge. It was Sara Lee, Virginia Power, and we had lots of smaller companies too. But when I was able to mine the healthcare claims data for these large corporations, the sample is large enough that you can really prove, you know, whether these things work or not. And I was able to definitively prove, without even having to do a statistical, you know, 95% accuracy. I mean, I was like, here's your cost before, here's your cost afterwards. We'll take out, we'll make one adjustment for inflation between this year and that year to level the playing field. And literally, I was able to prove that they saved $4 for every dollar. A company would save $4 for every dollar they spent on this prenatal risk management program, which was basically addressing pregnant women's behaviors while they were pregnant. And then, but they had other programs, chronic disease management, which was also a 24-hour call line, which and educational materials that were paid for by the employer that was provided to the employees that signed up for it. There's probably a charge added to your health insurance, whatever your portion was. But we couldn't prove that they saved money. So, like, if you had diabetes and you got this material, well, behavior change is difficult for one thing. And even if the people did change their behavior, the benefits that result in dollar savings were far in the future, right? Like, you got to spend all this money now to realize benefits later. But the lifespan of a typical employee was in 5 years, you know, it was getting shorter. It used to be a lifetime, and then, you know, from your whole adulthood, and it had whittled down to, I don't know, everybody was jumping jobs to move up the ladder instead of moving up within. Another thing I noticed, like, you know, why can't we climb the ladder anymore? Why can't I work my way up to management now? I have to be a cog in this wheel. But anyway, so it wasn't as appealing, and I was basically instructed by the president of our company to write reports that showed positive outcomes for these people so that they would continue to buy, or these companies, so they would continue to purchase the products. And I was like, well, the data doesn't show that, you know, I can show long-term benefits, but, you know, I can't just say that they saved all this money, because they didn't. They invested this money, and the savings are coming later in terms of lower healthcare expenses. So I didn't like that at all. It made me very uncomfortable. And she literally even wanted a program that would wanted me to hire a computer program consultant that would literally automate, go out and, like, pull the data, churn it out, and automate. I would write the standard report, and then the numbers in the report would be automatically populated. And I was like, there is not a single thing from one small company to another. Then small companies that had anywhere from 2 people to 100 people. When you got closer to 100, you know, you could have some real trends. But with one person, or 5 people or 10 people, one outlying health event would, like, skew all of the health data, right? The results. And I could mitigate some of that, but not much of it. And so I eventually just was so dissatisfied. I was like, I've got to get out of the corporate world. It's anti-life, you know, in my gut. I knew it was anti-life, anti-humanity. So I thought art school would be the answer.
So you're 32 and you went to art school.
Yeah, and I had never taken an art class. I didn't draw anything, but I was very mechanically inclined. And VCU in Richmond has one of the top sculpture programs.
And VCU is?
Virginia Commonwealth University.
Okay.
And I knew they enjoyed quirky, creative things, and I didn't know exactly what that meant, but my mother had gone there when it was RPI, Richmond Polytechnic Institute. She had.
Oh, tell what your mother did. I think this is so cool.
So she went to VCU under Teresa Pollock and got a degree in commercial art, and her second or third job out, she became a fashion illustrator, and she used to the full page ads that were hand drawn in magic markers of the fashion drawings for Tallheimer's, Miller and Rhodes, Macy's, that kind of thing. I don't know if Macy's was there then, but we had Tallheimer's and Miller and Rhodes downtown Richmond. She did those drawings. That's what she did. And She did that in a studio, in her studio, which was right next to my bedroom. And sometimes she would pull these crazy all-nighters, and I could smell the magic markers and hear the sounds. Like there's
and
all
she
this.
Had the architect's table and the lamp over it and all that cool stuff. That
she did, yeah. And I just loved it.
Yeah, and those are the fashion ads. My mom did not have that background, but she was a pretty good draw. She was a good artist. She could do some things.
Illustrator, yeah.
And mm-hmm. Well, not like your mom, not trained that mm-hmm. way, but she could.
Yeah, sure.
She made me. Oh boy, I wish I could find it. It's somewhere, I'm sure, tucked away. But she made me a set of paper dolls. She drew the tall, you know, elegant women. And then she made fashions for them and made the tabs and all of that. So they had different fashions that I could put on my own paper that my mom drew.
Nice. I remember those tabs.
Yeah.
Well, I hadn't thought of those in forever.
Yeah, I love that. So she did that. But anyway, your mother was trained and she was very good. And so those were the illustrations, old fashioned, but really elegant and lovely. And they, you know, always put together, and the idealized, the objectified woman.
Exactly. Well, and my mother was if I had to categorize her, she was like a 1950s diva Jackie Onassis type, right?
Ah.
Like Jacqueline Onassis would have been her ideal female representative.
Yeah.
You know, and it was important what the neighbors perceived than what you cared about, right? Like, so we had to keep secrets because we wouldn't want the neighbors to think anything. You know, not the way it's supposed to be. And then like Stepford Wives movie, I was like, oh my God, I live in the Stepford Wives movie. That had an impact on me, a visceral impact watching that movie.
That's
funny. Like, this feels real in a weird way. I know, like, that's not exactly what it's like, but it's sort of what it's like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry, we got off.
Well, so you went to the same school that your mother went to, but you were bringing in a different set of skills, mechanically inclined.
Right. So VCU, the School of Sculpture, appreciated quirky mechanical things. So I thought, well, I'm just going to go make weird stuff through VCU. I got accepted. I didn't have a portfolio. They had at the time, drawing exercises that you could submit. And I don't think I could get in now if I applied with my portfolio. I don't have the drawing skills. That's like the thing that they want.
And uh-huh.
To this day, I learned to draw in Art Foundation, but didn't practice it. So, you know, drawing stick figures is about as good as I get. with my idealism, I've always been a ridiculous, naive idealist that, you know, do right, work hard, everything's going to be good, you know. So I thought, well, I'm going to go to art school, and I'll have a creative life and everything will be good. And then what I figured out was, you know, it was just like the corporate world. I ended up working there, recruiting students, which is what I was doing on 9/11. I was in between events. But I quickly learned, you know, to become a successful artist, you had to then go sacrifice your life, live in a closet in New York to be like a sculpture artist, not a commercial artist. You had to go like live, you know, work as a waitress or a waiter or whatever and make no money, have a tiny studio and live in a closet sized place for about 5 years. And then you could build up over time, and then the art benefactors would make all the money and you would be allowed to make a reasonable living, but they would get wealthy off of your activities. And I'm like, but this is wrong. This is like this is not what I thought this was going to be. But I worked for the School of the Arts, and my job was to recruit students. VCU was not well known as an art school. Very far away from Virginia. Mm-hmm. So I literally was the first recruiter for the School of the Arts, and I went up and down the I-95 corridor. And so my territory was literally from Richmond up into Long Island, 95 up Long Island. Mm-hmm. And we later on went further north than that. But I was supposed to actually be working in one of the World Trade Center buildings on 9/11, but we had canceled the event because it was for performing.
Okay, we just lost our connection there for about 20 seconds. So you were saying when we cut out that they eventually went further than Long Island, but and then you kind of cut out. So
yeah, so anyway, well then my territory was up through New York and on to Long Island, but I was supposed to work an event on 9/11 in one of the Trade Center buildings, and
wow,
we canceled it literally on 9/11. With the day before, we canceled it. It was an expensive event to participate in. We didn't have much luck recruiting students because they wanted the out-of-state tuition. So here's another gaming the system. They hired me because they wanted to increase out-of-state enrollment because Virginia student enrollment costs like $4,000 a year. Out-of-state tuition was $12,000, $14,000 a year, mm-hmm. right? They are, mm-hmm. this is a revenue-based model, right, for an education right. system. I'm like, not sure how I feel about this. But I did it. I thought the school at the time was, you know, worthy of people pursuing a career in the arts. And I was an idealist, and I loved converting parents, particularly who questioned art as a career. And because I would say when they would want to know why I want my child to be a doctor, not an artist. They don't make any money. And I was like, wait a minute, you know, look around your world, your clothes, your car, your room, your office, your desk. There's not one thing. Name one thing that an artist hasn't touched. That an artist hasn't had a piece of the process of making it, you know, the thing that it is and the way that it looks. So anyway, this event on 9/11, we canceled it because it was expensive. It was for the performing arts. We didn't have any reputation up there. And we didn't have the strongest school, was my understanding, the strongest program to offer. So the dean's office was like, no, I'll just skip that event.
But you were already up there.
I was up there.
You were already up there ready for the event, but mm-hmm. when the decision was made.
I would station myself somewhere as a hub and then go to different schools, events, whatnot. And then I would come home, file all my papers and rejuvenate and then go back out on the road. So I was able to come home a day early because I wasn't doing that event. And I was literally driving down 95. I was going through the mixing bowl around D.C., Maryland, where 95 and the 495 circle. Let's see, 495 or 695. I think it's 495, where the traffic gets real heavy. And I had the radio on, and they were like, a plane has hit the World Trade Center, whichever building it was. And I was like, oh, my God. And then I drove by the Pentagon, and there was smoke pluming up in the air. And I was like, holy smokes, this is something that's going on. This is not right. And I can't remember if another plane hit then or whether I pulled off. I think I pulled off, and I went to a hotel in the bar area. And when the other second plane hit, and I was like, this is a setup. Like, it was a real...
Okay, but this is interesting because you're right there. You're in the D.C. area. D.C. and New York are...
Well, I was there 5 hours apart, 4 hours apart, but I was on my way back. I was driving from Long Island, from New York, and they hit. I was just north of D.C. when the plane hit, the first plane hit. And I don't remember the specifics, what hit one after the other.
But what I want to know, if you remember or if you've thought about it, you're in the bar of a hotel and the plane hits the second tower, and the first thought that seems to cross your mind is this is a setup. Why did you think that? I mean, what was going on in your brain that made you think that?
Well, I knew it wasn't just a random thing.
Well, how did you know that, though? I mean, how was it just like gut or?
Well, two planes, it didn't make sense. Like, okay. One plane hitting the tower, okay, maybe there was maybe the captain had a heart attack and, you know, didn't.
But immediately, you don't think this is terrorism. You think it's something funky.
Well, the first plane, I thought, that's, you know, that, you know, I would think they would have protections for that. And then the second one's like, no way. There's no way in hell two of these could happen. And then in the hotel, the first building fell, and it looked like a controlled demolition. And I was like, I don't think jet fuel can melt the structure of a building like that. I think they were probably designed to withstand an airplane hit. I can't imagine they wouldn't be designed to withstand.
Stop thinking.
And then the second one fell. I was like, oh, yeah, no. This is it. Just the logic of it and what they were saying in the news. Oh, and then, like, immediately, in all this rubble, they magically found the passport of the person that took over the plane. And then they knew the whole story, right? I was like, this lie is just a big lie, and it was very upsetting. But nobody can talk to anybody about it. They're like, no, it's not. They found his passport, you know. I'm like, no, they didn't. They had the passport, and they showed it on the news.
In pristine condition.
Right, exactly. They couldn't find anything else. They can't find a piece of the airplane in the rubble of the Pentagon. Not one piece, not a tail, wing, nothing. But they can find this pristine passport, you know. And the story didn't add up, you know. And then they're after some guy hiding in a cave with a handheld radio, who orchestrated all of this. You know, to me, it just made no sense whatsoever. It sounded fabricated. But then, you know, there's that saying, you know, the bigger the lie you tell, the more people believe, or whatever the saying is, you know, and tell it enough and it becomes, you know, what people believe. So
the Hitlerian model.
Exactly. Yeah. But I still didn't think like it was our country. You know what I mean? Like, I thought it was an act of terrorism against us because we are such bullies in the world, right? Like, we're military strong arming and we push everybody around. So I was in grad school at the time, and I was mad. I was mad at the election. What year was it? George W. Bush. Got selected, and they stole it, basically. I thought they stole the election.
W went in, didn't he go in like just 9 months before 9/11?
Yeah, but then next election.
Because
I was in grad school 2003 to 2006, right? So 9/11 was in my crawl, right? Like that. My antennas were up and I was watching stuff, and I knew stuff was not right. We weren't being told the truth. Why would they tell us about this passport? Why would they make up this story? So there was questions, you know, what's the motive of all of this? But I still, while I was working at VCU, a friend of mine introduced me to Noam Chomsky. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I got manufacturing consent, and that was complicated. I'm not good at reading history because I never was good at reading. And there's too many facts that don't mean anything to me because I never was a good history student. So I was like, okay, I need to understand what this guy's saying. So I bought a Chomsky for Beginners book or whatever. And it lays out literally his philosophy on why the newspapers, how the newspapers don't tell the truth, why they don't tell the truth, who feeds the information for them to report to people, And how they actually make more money when they narrow their audience instead of sell more subscriptions. And I remember having a very physically uncomfortable response to that. I was like in shock when I read that, and I understood it. I, like what he said made sense. I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. Right. So that reinforced the 9/11. I'm like, okay, they're definitely not telling the truth now about 9/11. But what is the truth? I don't know. So then I was reading. I was in grad school. I was upset about George Bush. George Bush and what was the
Gore.
Truth.
No, it was Gore was Clinton. It was. Didn't he run against Gore?
Yeah.
For his first or the second? I can't remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I can't remember now, but
I know it doesn't matter.
I was mad.
They're like puppets.
I was mad at them and the military industrial complex, and my artwork always reflected kind of my skepticism about our culture, things that upset me about our culture. And so I had made this basket. It was ginormous. It was Americana basket. I put it up on this giant pedestal that was like a milk paint blue, and I uplit it, and the basket was woven out of reed that I had stained tan, red, and blue. And out of it came this song, Happy Birthday, Mr. President, that a friend of mine read, that a friend of mine sang, like Marilyn Monroe. And so it was kind of commentary on America. Well, we have to have the biggest, baddest everything. You know, we're the best, American exceptionalism. And I just was really upset with our whole culture. And so I was digging around. I had, in part of my graduate studies, I was digging around and I came across the Unabomber's manifesto, and I printed it out and I was reading it, and it shocked me that I agreed with what he was writing. And I was like, that's interesting. And,
you know, an aside there, you know, did you ever look into Ted Kaczynski and his background and what was done?
I did. At some point, I discovered he had been an experiment in Harvard, a mind control experiment, subjected to that. But I don't know when I knew that. That was probably later in my explorations. I somehow came across the Project for a New American Century website, and I started rebuilding America's defenses. And it was dreadfully boring and very difficult for me to read because I don't have the greatest reading skills, and I don't understand the importance of the Middle East countries that they were after. You know what I mean? I don't have all the pieces in place to make sense of why they want all of this. But I'm like, you're gonna read through it. Just get through it. You'll learn. You'll start figuring out stuff. And I was, I don't know, 50 pages in, and there's this sentence that said, you know, and they've laid out, oh, we've got to invade this country, and then that one, and that one, and that one, so that we can have all this power. It's what I remember. I don't really remember all the reasons that they said, but they had their reasons laid out, and I was disgusted. And then this sentence popped out at me. And it was like, and this will take a very long time unless there's a precipitating event such as a Pearl Harbor. and I was like, 9/11. That's it. 9/11. This was in 2004 that I had this epiphany that I found this doc. And then I'm like, when did they write this? And it was like in the night. Was it in the late 1990s or something like that? I was like, this is before 9/11. And so that like that was it. That's when I was like, okay, that's it. I'm deep diving. I'm going down the rabbit hole. I got to find out what's going on. And then I just
everything. How did you even, was it just an accident that you stumbled on to PNAC and that document? Was this just like one of those?
I'm not sure how I came across it. I found back then you could find things, you know, searching for. I might have even typed in what are the goals of the neocons or something, you know what I mean?
Right.
It might have been something that simple.
There is so much that is very interesting about the Project for the New American Century, and specifically about the neocons and what their background was. And Are you familiar with E. Michael Jones?
That name doesn't ring a bell.
Well, he's Catholic. I'm not, you know, I'm not making an endorsement here, but I have actually read a lot of E. Michael Jones. But he gives a very, in something that he has written or a series of lectures, he gives you the background of the various people who made up what we call the neocons. And what you find, the thread, well, there are several threads, but the one that I'm going to focus on is the fact that they came out of very liberal backgrounds, far to the left. And in order to get their agenda forward, they make this pivot to the right. So the whole idea of neoconservatism is it's really not conservatism. That's the first thing that you have to know about it. Also, before we get too far away, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. Have you ever seen the documentary? Alan has referred to it quite a few times. Das Net, or the Net. This is going to blow your mind. It's available online. Watch it today.
I will.
Yeah. Watch it today. There are so many. It's so interesting. You're going to make connections. A lot of these players Alan talked about. So when this documentary was done, he immediately reached out to the filmmaker. They had one off, you know, air conversation, but it's just amazing what he put together. Now, some people say he's a German that made the film. And some people say, oh, it's authorized, et cetera, et cetera. But what he lays out, weaving in the Unabomber throughout it, is cultural control, the deification of scientists. Because remember, the Unabomber's manifest, he's got a real problem with science, you know, or what we might even call scientism, but the religion of science. And Kaczynski's background was, he was a mathematician. So that's the way his mind worked. It's logic, so science that just has theories and is a work in progress, that wasn't appealing to the way his mind worked. And you've got Stuart Brand, who I can't remember the publication. He's like the godfather of Silicon Valley. So all these tech guys, and it was Stuart Brand who, you know, we will become as gods. We might as well get good at it. And this is Yuval Noah Harari kind of thinking. Oh, yeah. That all of the tech world in Silicon Valley has been incredibly influenced by the work of Stuart Brand and the people that were in his group at the time. And then John Brockman was involved in some of the early testing of how strobe lights in a disco, and of course there were some drugs involved in these tests. They don't, you know, we're not going to talk about that officially, but the strobe light and music combination is documented. And he ended up becoming a manager or an agent, you know, but for writers in New York. And his focus was scientists. And he is star maker. I mean, he's getting up there now, but he was a star maker. He's one who took just a scientist and, you know, keep hammering, you know, raise the profile, get them on talk shows, et cetera, make them gods. And it's just a coincidence, isn't it, that he's that he was friendly, that he hung out with Jeffrey Epstein. So,
go figure.
But you're going to see these amazing connections kind of come together in that documentary. I think you're going to be
that's right up my
really knocked out. Yeah, yeah. So carrying forward with the story and your explorations?
Well, then my thesis project, I was upset they were marketing the H2 Hummer to soccer moms. A military assault vehicle was being marketed to soccer moms to for their, you know, their grocery trips and running their kids to sporting events and whatnot. And I was like, and then they were given tax credits. Literally, like, these are, they get 3 miles to the gallon. They they're so over the top ridiculous. They look like something from a military theater, which they are. And they have no practical use whatsoever, but they're you get, if you had a business, you could get a full tax credit. So $83,000 for one of these things, you get that $83,000 back immediately when you file your taxes, right? I was like, oh, you're getting a free Hummer, right? That's why there was mm-hmm. Hummers everywhere. You got a free Hummer. It just took a few months for you to get the money back, right? I was like, why is that? And then they did that car thing. You trade your car in and they destroyed all the cars, right? There was an incentive uh-huh. to get new cars, and they didn't repurpose the cars. They just destroyed them. It didn't make sense. So I made a Hummer for my thesis project, and I stuck it right in the middle of a Zen garden. Literally to scale, I went to the Hummer dealership at night and measured everything, and they had the basic dimensions on their website, and I made a three-dimensional drawing out of steel square tubing. So it's a drawing in space, and then everywhere the wheels touch in the rock garden, it ripples out like water. So basically, and that's a commentary not only on the Hummer, but also the commodification of Zen Buddhism, right? Like, mm-hmm. oh, get yourself a little thing to calm yourself down on your anxious days, right? A Zen garden, right? The little sand pit with the rake in it, right? On the executive desk, because they mm-hmm. have stressful days, they can just rake the sand. I was like, okay, so we're gonna stick this thing in the Zen garden. And then I made plaster copies of the presidential seal and stuck them like as walking in my thesis presentation. I made a giant Zen rake, and these presidential seals were stepping stones in the garden. Anyhow, that was the end of school.
Well, the soccer mom thing and marketing to soccer moms, and the stressed out CEOs with the Zen garden, little sand thing. They came in a pretty little wooden shallow box, and you could rake it and decorate right. it. Well, the latest thing that they've been pushing to soccer moms, and if you put in your search engine, you're probably going to be able to come up with it. But microdosing psilocybin or microdosing LSD or whatever, and right. soccer moms together, put it together and see what you come up with, because there are, I've linked to this. I've shown this before. And also the CEOs, there was an article that came out in December in the New York Times about how the CEOs are tripping. So it's the same themes over and over. But when you were telling about the promotion of the Hummer to the soccer moms, I thought, oh, heaven forbid, if they still have, or if they're still driving a Hummer, now they're tripping on psilocybin. So you've got a soccer mom in this tank who's like,
I think Elon.
It's scary.
Elon might have been tripping at the inauguration. There's somebody got a video of him, and his eyes were going all over the place.
Well, he's a joke. He's a buffoon. Right. Let's just yeah. face it. But I mean, if you look for Elon Musk promoting hallucinogens and stuff. I found one the other day. He was on some, you know, just like hanging out on somebody's podcast that looked like a couple of guys in their mom's basement.
Right.
And he's just sitting down there, you know, talking about tripping.
Because he's got all the time in the world to just trip days away.
Well, you know, I think he does. I mean, the idea that he's running these multinational corporations is ludicrous. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he was, you know, tripping. I'm wearing, this is actually warm and it's really cold in here, but when I grabbed it out of the closet this morning, I thought, oh no, everybody was talking about how Trump was wearing a purple tie at the, you know, and I'm like, oh, I've got a purple scarf on. What does it mean?
Right. Yeah. Everything's hyper analyzed.
So you did this and you're getting yourself as an artist kind of, in a way, politicized. You're making statements.
Yeah, and then my job came to an end. The online recruitment became a much bigger thing, and they ended. And I was told when I was hired, they're like, you know, our enthusiasm for recruitment waxes and wanes, and this may not be a long-term position. It lasted 7 years.
That's pretty good.
They replaced me supposedly by online applications, but they couldn't do that because there's a portfolio, and they ended up just doling out my responsibilities to other people. They just added hats to other people's responsibilities. Mm-hmm. They got rid of my salary, right? Like, you know, it's just, you know, how corporations do, because the VCU had become very corporatized. The president of the school was very corporate, and of course it's all about grant money. You know, the more grants you get, the better, the more publicity. That he created the Siegel mm-hmm. Center, right, so that we could mm-hmm. have the basketball contests, the basketball tournaments, which then put VCU's name on the map in a lot of different ways, and it helped raise money for different things. And our medical school, he changed the name of the medical school to VCU from MCV so that it had the name recognition. And at one of our meetings, he's like, you should buy property in Richmond because it's going to go up as we keep growing. They, you know, start to accumulate property all over the place. And anywhere, if you're anywhere near there, your property value is just escalating. Or you might get a big purchase from them, right? Like, they might buy your property for more than it's worth. So I was recognizing the corporatization of the school, the entire school. And the art school used to be a really great place to go to school and to work. And it had become another corporate hole. Really, mm-hmm. by the time I was out, and now nobody I know there is happy anymore. It's just awful. But I don't know about the quality of the art education. I can't imagine that it hasn't suffered. But, you know, I don't know. I'm not been involved in it, so I can't say with any direct firsthand experience. But it was an excellent school, and it was perfect for finding the diamonds in the rough and polishing them up and presenting mm-hmm. them to the world as mm-hmm. artists, right? People who really had skills but couldn't get in because they didn't have the right SAT scores or this or that. Now they don't even require SAT scores anymore, I don't think, for college entry. You know,
really?
Dumb that down. Yeah, a friend of mine, my freshman roommate from Tech, she's been supporting herself. She actually ended up going to Harvard and getting her MBA. And she was doing, she worked with the guy that started, not Bill Gates, one of the other guys involved in the start of Microsoft. But she was like his.
Oh, I can't remember his name.
Yeah. Yeah, he's sort of a household name if you were back.
But I can't remember it.
But she's flown on
planes. Paul Allen, no.
No, who was the IBM person? Maybe it was IBM.
I can't think.
But so anyway, in her work experience for this company, she's flown on airplanes with Bill Gates and all these people. And of course, I'm like wanting to know, you know, well, tell me about this. And I proposed my thoughts on Bill Gates. She's like, oh no, he's a true philanthropist. I'm like, oh dear. Okay, well, I don't think we can go. But so far in this conversation, she was totally. And but she's But what she ended up doing after she left that job, she was a, you know, you could take those Kaplan courses, right, to learn to become, to ace your MCATs and ace your SATs. She did that. She was a consultant, college entry consultant, and people paid big bucks for her to train their children to ace those exams and to say just the right thing on the application and to write the right essays and all of that. Because she knew exactly what the big firms were looking for. So she knew how to get them into the schools and how to say all the right things. But she told me the other day she's looking for new work because they didn't require those anymore. So I don't know. She didn't say, you know, whether it was across the board or what, but
you may tell her to just hold on a little bit, because I think that what is being heavily promoted right now is the idea of meritocracy. And there's the whole H-1B visa thing that blew up. But, you know, to me, it's just your political / billionaire tech slaveholders who are telling their slaves, you're going to have to work harder.
Right.
Because that's what merit is. You know, I mean, if we think about it in our idealistic way down here, it's like, well, yes, I want to work hard and I want to do a good job. And then I expect to be rewarded for working hard and do, you know, but meritocracy to them means we're going to work you to the bone.
Right.
You are going to, you know, start getting math lessons in the womb, you know, this kind of thing. And the whole STEM thing, yeah. And I did not, to the chagrin of both my aunts who reprimanded me, I did not watch the inauguration yesterday. But I did catch, my brother was watching television and I like to come through every now and then and be sociable. And he was watching the live coverage of Trump signing the executive orders while he was talking to the reporters. And at one point, he made a comment about, you know, he said, he looked at the journalists and the camera and he said, we're going to return to meritocracy. What a concept. And so we're getting it over and over. It's Ramaswamy and Musk. But what they're really saying is, we're not going to do anything about the manufacturing that we offshored 30 years ago. We're going to have some publicity about tariffs, et cetera, et cetera. But we're not really bringing manufacturing back. There's, you know, this middle class that's gone, that's been gone for a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. They're not coming back. You know, what we're going to have is at least 4 years of us telling you to work harder and get maths and science and engineering in the schools. That's what it is. So your friend could be well hanging on to her SAT tutoring, because I think we're swinging away from woke and leveling the playing field so that, you know, no matter how you did in school, they're going to give you a leg up, because otherwise, you know, it doesn't fit in with the DEI inclusive model of, you know, everybody's equal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a different, we're taking a different tack, I think, and it's going to be.
Yeah, at least that's what they're saying.
Yes.
We'll see how it plays out. although he's taken some pretty big steps right out of the gate. So I'm relieved. At least we get a break from things for a while. I may not like the outcome any better than where we were headed ultimately, but I'm relieved to have a break from the way things were.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, this is like theater at one level, but for sure, the in-your-face, nonstop DEI woke agenda
It was painful.
Yeah, it was super painful. So, carrying on in the story.
So, I when my job ended, I worked for myself. One of the things I did to help pay for school and expenses was I became a personal trainer. It was something I was always interested in. I was always very athletic. And so I started an in-home personal training business. And I never was busy full-time. So I had a lot of free time on my hands. And I just decided to deep dive in my exploration of, you know, what's going on, what's really going on in the world. How does this world really work? Mm-hmm. And how am I going to negotiate my way through it? Which I still haven't figured out that part, because the trap just keeps, you know, whatever direction you go in, the trap is set up in every direction, it seems. Except spiritually, like there seems to be a relief valve spiritually if you don't fall into one of the spiritual traps that they've set up, right? It's like, sort of like you're on your own, and if you figure out how to get through on your own, then you're free. But somehow you have to do it without dependence on everything in your world around you, and on the systems that are set up to guide you.
Well, that's it. That's kind of the ding, ding, ding. It is. It's an inside job. It's a solo job. It's a lonely.
It is lonely. So I've lost a lot of friends, or alienated them, particularly with COVID. My friends are mostly liberal like I was, and then COVID came along and I didn't, you know, I looked up, I research everything. And when they were talking about doing a vaccine that was made with mRNA technology, I was like, oh, no way. Like they haven't tested that enough. I don't want anybody like messing with my DNA. You know, that's scary. That has permanent multi-generational impacts. Mm-hmm. So I was like, no. That's, you know, years later where I was more fully formed with my alt education. And by that time, I was working for one of my clients. My most recent job has been working for an expert in the prevention of child sexual abuse. This is after working in fitness and health for 12, 15 years, something like that. She was one of my fitness clients, and I ended up working for her, and she's very liberal, education, PhD in education. And she kept asking me if I was getting the vaccine. And I was like, that doesn't make sense to me. And she's like, yeah, but the science, how can you deny the science? And I'm like, because they're not doing the science, right? Science is questioning everything. They're not questioning it. They haven't done the research. It's not FDA approved. Not that I trust the FDA, but that's better than not being approved, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was also gave me a little bit of time, bought me some time from her harassment over that. And like literally, as things got more and more intense, I worked in the basement. I was already relegated there to where my office was in the basement. And if I came upstairs, you know, she was wearing a mask and a shield and a this and a that, you know, and if I stepped in the room, she would literally scooch up against the wall to get away from me. So I was let go from that job essentially for not complying with the mandate.
Not keeping your distance.
And then she hired me back. I mean, I did a pretty good job for her, and I had other skills other than what I was doing for her. And after my replacement didn't work out and caused her problems, she hired me to work from my home where I didn't pose a risk. But it was shocking. Like, she came in my office one day and she was like, so do you do drugs? And I was like, what kind of drugs? No, not really. But what are you referring to? Like, you know, heroin or pills or... And I was like, no. And she's like, what about pot? And I was like, well, I've done pot, but I don't really actively smoke pot or whatever. And she's like, what about alcohol? You know, looking for something, you know. And I'm like, well, yeah, I drink alcohol. And she's like, well, do you enjoy putting people at risk? Like, do you drive around while you've been drinking. And she had NPR on in the background in her office anytime she wasn't on a business call or Skype or not Skype, she Zoomed for all of her phone calls and stuff. And so I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, this is the weirdest conversation I've ever had. But I think there must have been something. They speculate on the unvaccinated motivations of the unvaccinated people. And I think there must have been something out there being promoted to them that said that we were risk takers and loved putting people in danger.
Well, I remember this was not too long after I got back from Canada in the States, that I had to take a bit of a trip on the freeway. And so this would have been the very end, I'm thinking the end of 2021. And they had, you know how they have those lit up traffic lights that say there's road work ahead or the roads are icy or drive, you know, proceed with caution, whatever.
Right.
This one said, something like, you wouldn't let your teenager drive without a seatbelt. Why are you letting him be unvaccinated?
Oh, dear.
It was very succinct, you know, in marketing language. But and sure enough, once I saw it, then, you know, down the road in this particular area, every 10 miles there it was again. And I thought, wow, that. And
repetition. Uh-huh.
And I grew up, my mother leaned liberal, and probably because she listened to NPR all the time, which is National Public Radio. I don't know. So I grew up with National Public Radio in the house, you know, all the time. And that, because I was out in the middle of nowhere, that was one of the few stations that I could pick up. So while I'm seeing these signs, I am also hearing a whole like 30-minute special on NPR about wedding planning in the age of COVID. And it's just, you know, should you invite people if you know that they're not vaccinated? And it was just so disgusting. I almost couldn't bear to listen to it, but I made myself listen to it because it was educational. Yeah, it was painful. So it was during this time, mm-hmm. 2020, when you're going to your mother's house. She's got Fox on, which is kind of conservative, and it would have normally freaked you out, but you're responding to it, and you're going, okay, Tucker Carlson, he's saying the right thing here.
Some of the other talk show hosts, I was like, oh dear, I sort of agree. I agree with what they just said. It was I was shocked at myself.
And this is when you discovered Alan's talks.
Around this time, and I for the life of me cannot figure out how I found his work. I know that it was the podcast, and it must have been, I think it must have been a comment in one of the videos I watched or something. Somebody said, you got to listen to Alan Watts cutting through the matrix, because he was still alive. Uh-huh. And I started listening, because I took a break from it for a while. I don't remember why. I got busy or something, and you know, I listen to so much stuff, sometimes I just have to take a break from all of it, like it's mm-hmm. overwhelming. And when I came back, had the introductions with you and the contextual discussion, and then playing his information. So I was like, oh my gosh, what happened to him? And then at some talk you had mentioned he passed, and so I was like, oh no, this is terrible. You know, I wondered if somebody had done something to him because he's so potent. But I immediately, upon first listening, was like, this is the guy that I wish I had found right out of the gate, because mm-hmm. he's so good at like giving you the pieces and showing you how it all works and mm-hmm. all hidden stuff. This is what's hidden from you. This is why they do this. And I mean, it just was everything. It was so good. You know, from then on, I was like, really, it's in my, I put the podcast on when I get in my car. Anytime I've got downtime when nobody's home, I turn it on. And it's...
And you're talking about how history was always maybe more difficult because you weren't a great reader and everything. But when he puts things across, it's very easy to understand. There may be a word that you don't know. You've got to go to the dictionary, or there may be things. Sometimes I have the feeling, even now, but especially when I first started listening to him, okay, just this one talk, I could be researching this one talk
for a lifetime,
you know.
Right.
Yeah. But in spite of how dense they were and how layered and how full of information and everything, there was something about his delivery and his clear thinking and the way he communicated things quite calmly that it felt simple at the same time. Do you know what I mean?
It is simple, really. I mean, yeah. There's an agenda and they're following it and they're hiding it from you. And he shows you the hidden keys and puts it in terms that make sense. I'm grateful that I found him when I did. I wish I had found his work earlier. I've actually shared it with a bunch of people, and one or two have actually started listening.
That's actually really impressive, because most people don't, even people who say they're seeking truth.
It has to be a soundbite. Even if they're wanting to know information and open to stuff, it still has to come in digestible bits.
I know. Alan used to go ahead.
I posted one of the talks on Facebook, and I just, you know, the link to the podcast, and I was like, listen if you dare, you know. And, you know, it was like crickets, you know, nobody responded. And then finally one guy chimed in who I've seen say some alternative things. And he was like, oh, this is great. You get the bad news from a really pleasant voice, right? So that guy, I know that guy started listening to him. And another friend that I was my valedictorian of my high school, he's been on there, arguing against Trump, like in very violently arguing against Trump. And I'm like, dude, as smart as you are, you know, like, they're all on the same side. Like, what are you, you know, going on about? He's like, I know, but the end is coming faster with him. And I'm trying to get people to wake up, you know. And I'm like, you're just scaring people. Listen to this guy, right? And he actually listened. And he was like, oh, my gosh, thank you for sending this. I can't believe I didn't find him earlier. So, and I know he's listening diligently.
Great.
Yeah, but I know he's still bashing Trump nonstop. Every post is something anti-Trump. You're wasting your energy.
It is. It really is. I mean, it's so clever, though, how it's done. It is its own politics. Really, is its own art form. It's just amazing. It's so.
Well, they've become such masters of manipulation. It's like they're all trained. I'm not, you know, always wondering, like, how did they get so good at manipulating the public? But, like, they've studied those that studied human behavior, right? Yeah. And they've mastered the techniques. And, you know, if we get to a digital world, they won't even have to be masters of that, because you'll be so unplugged from your soul, you know. It's gonna unplug you from caring. You live in a virtual world, or, you know, be guided to do things by who knows what technology, and not have any personal interests. I don't know, that whole digitization and transhumanism thing, that's not much scares me, but that really scares me for humanity.
Well, you know, I mean, I've said this You touched on spiritual, and there's just never a good word to our language. English is an impoverished language, let's face it. We just don't have the words for things, but there is something, I think, inside of us that recognizes truth, so that no matter where you are, where you're sitting, what your background is, whether you are on the left or you're on the right, or you were raised an atheist, or you're raised, you know, when you hear truth, it's like, if you've got it in you, like that's like, you hear Alan and you go, okay, wow, that's true. And there is something in us along that same pathway that knows what is true, what is real, what is right, what is wrong, but it's obscured. And it is, like you said, they study us so carefully and we're so well manipulated. But if you start to clean that out, however that is, if it's taking a break from all media or whatever your technique for quieting your mind is, that I think that that is where the answers lie of how you get through this.
Right.
I've had long discussions with people that have questions such as, if this technology, because we can speculate, how is it going to work? You know, is it something that's injected? Is it nanotechnology? Is it aerosolized? Is it, you know, we used to think in terms of a brain chip, but there's a grid. And once you are there, what distinguishes you, what makes you unique, and what makes you sentient is gone.
Right.
And they openly talk. Somebody just sent me a clip of someone, I think, speaking at the World Economic Forum. And this is not new. I don't know how old it is, but it's not brand new. But talking about how your memories can already be hacked, replaced, tweaked, given false memories. This is very easy for them to do. And they can give you a whole history about yourself
right now.
Without a brain chip or without a bio-digital convergence. They can give you something that you would swear is the truth about you that has actually been implanted into you. So these technologies, and Alan has talked about this in one form or another forever. And I was so struck, I've said this before, but I think about it regularly. After he passed away, I started to reread at a certain point, you know, maybe a month later, a couple months later, I said, well, it's been a long time since I read the Cutting Through books. I'm going to start reading that. And it was on page 5 of the first volume. So right there, he wrote, this is the final phase of humanity as we know it. And I just thought, why didn't that leap out at me while he was alive? Why couldn't I ask him, you know, how long does this phase last? You know? But I was completely...
Let me get my calendar. How long is this?
You know, and I mean, it's like, he didn't say this is the, you know, the final 20 years or the final the phase. A phase could be, you know, what, 100 years or 500, but the final phase. And he didn't write things or say things that weren't considered, that, you know, he didn't just wing it. And that... It amazed me on one hand, because I thought he always knew the direction that this was going. He spoke about it very clearly and simply for many, many years. And he knew that not a lot of people would come through this phase or survive it, because it takes everything. I mean, it is simple, but it really takes a commitment to understanding it and being willing to survive having, you know, friendships and relationships kind of crumble because they're sick of hearing you say that, or they think you're all doom and gloom. And you know, just this hunger, this insatiable hunger to understand reality and to not accept the lies. So there's all of that in there. And yeah, and I knew he knew where it was going, and I knew that he didn't think very many people were going to come through, and yet to him it was worth it. All of the sacrifices that he made, all of the time that he spent on it, you know, the all of his dedication was worth it.
For the just few that are going to get
it. For the very few that are going to get it. And that had a profound effect on me, you know, that if he would be willing to sacrifice for such a few people, then obviously it's worth it.
Right.
But how the technology by which it happens, I mean, there are some interesting people that have whose work I've been introduced to. One person that I want to talk to sooner than later, I've spoken to but not recorded with, has a background out of Silicon Valley doing not surveillance camera but camera technology. And during COVID, he just put things together for himself. And, you know, things started to click. I've got this background. And, you know, so he's been able to see, well, if they've got this technology for total surveillance, which is the internet and everything that goes along with it, then, and they've got the cloud, where everything goes to the cloud, and they've got the blockchain. So this is important. People get stuck on cryptocurrency, which may become the currency. We, you know, we'll go without cash, and this may be what they're presenting us, but not to get trapped by the idea of money or currency, but a credit. And it's, and when the concept that he out of Silicon Valley is explaining is what they call in the internet language, zero trust. And the zero trust is really the equation. You come into the interaction or the equation. And we think of trust as like, you know, an emotional thing or a relationship thing. But it's like you're engaging with a formula. Do you trust it? So you enter into the formula and you demand from the other side of the equation proofs, you know, and that's really what the credit system is based on. So we're entering a digital world, and I'm sure that I'm just butchering this. He'll laugh about it, but you know, so we're entering this world in which everything that you need and everything that you want, this is the, you know, on the way in to this, before you're just there and there's no way out. But on the way in, everything that you need, you have to verify, you have to prove, you have to overcome the zero trust obstacle.
Right, and you have to accept their terms. You can't even use your phone now. They upgrade your phone and it's like, do you accept the new terms of whatever? Mm-hmm. And if you say no, then you can't use your phone.
That's right.
Like you're locked out of your phone if you say, no, I don't accept this. There's nowhere to negotiate.
No. And this is the way that it is really with everything. If you look, first of all, the internet just had everything on it, you know, 20 years ago. And then, you know, 10 years ago, it had more of everything.
Right.
And now everything that you need is either behind a paywall of subscription-based model, or else you're having to verify that you're a human, or you know, give us your password, or get, you know, it's a whole step of proving who you are and gaining that trust.
Yeah, for
in the equation,
safety, right?
Like, right, exactly,
for our own protection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that model will dissipate because eventually enough people will comply that it will just be the universal thing, whether it's, and he sent me some pictures. He had encountered his first, you know, bio, you know, where you could not get into someplace without, without the biometric.
I have resisted and resisted it. My phone is constantly wanting me to have a biometric entry into the phone. I'm like, no, stop asking me. I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Because once you're in the system, right, then they share that information, then they can...
Everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
No, a great deal of, at this point, a great deal of caution has to be exerted because, you know, I notice if I'm signing into different things, that has now become a constant. We can make this faster. And it's like, you know, no, slow's okay. Right. It's all right. It works for me.
Yeah. And they're, they're scraping the internet, like literally digital scrapers going through collecting images of people and information, yada, yada. And then they're selling it, right, to the FBI and the CIA, the three-digit agencies, and the police or whatever, because they can't, without a warrant, can't collect that information, but they can buy it. It's like a sideline for getting information that they need a warrant for, but they can get it legally. I don't know. It feels overwhelming, really.
Well, I think the important thing is not to be overwhelmed.
Right.
You know, the important thing is to look for the little ways. I need to go shortly. But speaking of not being overwhelmed and doing positive things and contributing in the way that you can and somehow doing the best that you can, you are starting a new adventure.
I am.
Yes. Well, you may not remember what it is, but your new business venture, you've got a name for it and everything, and I wanted you to tell us about it.
It's not official yet. I don't have my business license in place, but it's going to be called Sunshine Alley's Good Clean Stuff. I've always been health minded, research, not just on all these things, but on food and health and nutrition. And I want people to be able to make healthy choices in a toxic world.
I like that.
Yeah.
Healthy choices in a toxic world.
And the website, I've owned the web name for a long time and not been able to figure, there's so much that fits under the name that I haven't been able to figure out what I'm going to do, but I'm going to use it now. It's called saynotocrap.com. And so basically, the focus will be this business, although say no to crap could apply to all sorts of things, but really like the initial out of the gate thing will be like healthy snacks for you and your dog and healthy home, the stuff that I've been making for years, house cleaners that have no toxins in them that work better than the chemical version that you buy at the store, deodorants that are aluminum free but work better than the deodorants that you can buy and that kind of thing. I'm going to grow microgreens. I do have a garden. Perhaps it could get even further than microgreens. But I'm not sure where all it's going to go, but basically helping other people make better decisions for their own health and to avoid the toxic waste that are really pushed on us from all directions, from the grocery store, the doctors, everybody seek health advice. You go to WebMD, you get all kinds of good information there. things that aren't really necessarily good for you. So, I can't, I'm not a doctor, but I always have followed what I felt, worked for me for health. And I just want other people to be able to make more informed decisions and have access to good, clean stuff that's hard to find.
Mm-hmm. And even, some of your dog snacks just sound so great.
Yeah. Right out of the gate, the dog snacks that I've made so far, and I have some other ideas, but initially I took sweet potatoes and I tried dehydrating them, but the texture was wrong. And so I baked them and then sliced them up and then dehydrated them, and they They're vibrantly orange, like they're really pretty looking. They actually break down when the dogs, if the dogs do swallow them whole, which the dogs would swallow the other ones whole and it came out whole, right? These actually break down if they don't actually chew them up, but the dehydrated sweet potato slices are like chews. You can take them camping, right? They're like a good light snack that you can carry with you and your dog can eat them and you can eat them. The sweet potato skins are a nice crunchy snack. They actually taste good, and the dogs love them. And they, you know, it's always fun to see the dogs crunching on the snacks rather than just gulping them down. So you get a little joy when the dog actually like crunches on the chips. And try to, you know, keep things light.
And the microgreens, what's involved in that, in growing them and then processing them?
Well, there's different ways that you can use them, but right, you know, as they're growing, they get, you know, so it'll be like broccoli and pea sprouts and radish sprouts, and so you can eat them straight up, or you can put them on salads. You can garnish your entrees with them to make them look prettier, fancier. But they have tons of nutrients, nutrient dense, right? And as a fitness and nutrition person, I always like encourage my clients to eat nutrient dense food, because they always went for the low nutrient stuff that tasted good, you know. Like, try to get something that actually has something in it that's good for you. And these are like jam packed. But I'm going to also, the ones that I can't sell while they're live, I'm going to dehydrate them, and then they can be ground into powders and added to smoothies. You could actually sprinkle them on something dehydrated. They don't have to be still live to use in that way. So, and then they have shelf storage longevity, right? Like the microgreens, fresh cut, if you don't dehydrate them, they have to be eaten or used right away, or they
right
put them in your compost.
Maybe you could come up with an alternative to the greenies, you know, for dogs.
Oh,
those are so expensive.
Yeah, I'm sure it's junk food, right? Like, there's probably not much nutritional. Look at the package. One thing I want to figure out is snacks for cats, because I have the pickiest cats and they won't eat anything, but they do love greenies. And every time I give it to them, I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm poisoning you. I don't, you know, don't eat too many of these. But I say that I haven't really researched the nutrition in the greenies. Maybe there's some good stuff in them, but I'm almost certain there's some bad stuff in them as well.
Well, they're sold, the way they're marketed, and I haven't looked at an ingredient of them for a long time, but the way they're marketed is being so healthy and greenies, of course, they're green. It must be good, and it's good for your teeth and all of that.
Convenient name for now, right?
Like, exactly. But they're just a fortune.
Yeah, they are. And one thing, like with the dog treats, you know, the ingredient, I love, like, the ingredient label says ingredients, sweet potato, right?
Yes.
Right. I love that. But I got to figure out something that the cats will enjoy too, because it's not fair, you know, for you and your dog to have all the fun and the cats be left out and not get the good nutritional stuff. So I don't know what that'll be, but I'll be experimenting on my animals.
Yeah. Well, that's fun. Well, I really enjoyed this. I thank you for taking the time from your schedule and talking to me. And I think this is a good, interesting peek into somebody's thought process about coming to terms with this bogus story that they give us and call reality.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your interest, because there's so many people are not interested. It's shocking to me how uninterested people are. I don't know. But I found, you know, like, the people that I've started to come together with, we have one thing we have in common is a deep compassion for humanity, right? Like, and want to understand the truth and how to negotiate through the world. And it's really brought me to some really amazing people. And I'm grateful there's a community of us out here.
That's great. DOSNet.
I'm going to look it up.
I can't remember the German filmmaker's name. It's just gone out of my head. But you'll be blown away. It's a very interesting trip. And it'll be one of those things, too, where you're like, well, I could be researching that forever.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. And thank you for all you do. To promote Alan's work. I just think it's so important.
I do. I think his work is essential. It's required if you want to know what's going on. It's just the best. It's concise. It's compassionate. It is
comprehensive.
Yes, it's very comprehensive.
Right.
So next week on Real History, I am speaking with Rick in Australia. And Rick is a longtime listener to Alan's material. And we've actually never spoken. We've emailed back and forth for a long time now. And so I'm looking forward to that conversation. And Allison, thank you again. I'm looking forward to following the progress of Sunshine Alley.
Thank you.
So keep us posted. We'll do that. All right. Thank you. Take care.
All right. Have a good one.
If you miss the train I'm on, you will know that I am can hear the whistle blow 100 miles, 100 miles, 100 miles, 100 miles. You can hear the whistle blow 100 miles. Lord, I'm one. Lord, I'm two. Lord, I'm three. I'm 500 miles away from home, away from home, away from home, away from home, away from home. Lord, I'm 500 miles away from home. Not a shirt on my back, not a my name. Lord, I can't go back home this away, this away, this away, this away, this away. Lord, I can't go back home this away. Miles. You can hear the whistle.